Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Metaphysical Hour. I'm Julia Cannon, and today is March 17th of 2017. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. It just dawned on me. That's what it is. My goodness, March already. We're just plugging right along. We have coming up our UFO conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and that's going to be April 14th to the 16th. And this is our 30th anniversary. So the 30 years this conference has been going on, and with wonderful people like our guests tonight. But if you've never been, this is, you know, it's the longest running UFO conference, maybe in the world, but definitely, I think it's definitely in the U.S., or it's continuously running, and it's one of the largest. It's not the largest, but it's one of them. But we always have fantastic people that are just so wonderful at researching, and they're having their experiences, and that's what this conference is all about. And that's why I'm going to bring in our special guest tonight. Is James Clarkson, who is the Washington State Director of MUFON and the Special Assignments Team for MUFON. And MUFON, probably anybody in the UFO field probably knows what that means, but that's the Mutual UFO Network. Is that correct? Yeah, correct, James?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, anyway, so that's, what I like to do is have you tell your story. So I'm not going to read a lot about you and everything. We're going to experience it firsthand. But we are so excited to have you as one of our guest speakers this year. And thank you so much for coming on to the show, James Clarkson.
Well, it's a pleasure, Julia. I mean, I guess the question is, where do you start? And that's all. That's always the question with UFOs in general, because, you know, arbitrarily, we say the modern era of unidentified flying objects. And if you know your history, that is 1947. Mm-hmm. And as people from Washington State, I always like to brag because we tell all those Roswell people, actually, they came here first, because about a week and a half or so before the July 4th weekend of 1947, on June 24th, Kenneth Arnold, who was a businessman who sold fire suppression equipment throughout the Northwest by flying a small plane to remote places, he was flying across Mount Rainier, and in broad daylight, he saw a formation of metallic crescent-shaped objects, and by timing them, he saw them long enough that he could maneuver around, keep them in sight. He used a stopwatch, and he timed how long it took them to go between two mountain peaks, which was a known distance. And as I recall, he estimated their velocity at about 1,200 miles an hour. So you have to ask yourself, who in 1947 was flying metallic aircraft that could go 1,200 miles an hour?
Exactly.
So, wow. And it gets even better. Yeah. Because when he landed, mm-hmm. the newspapers picked it up with a vengeance, and the whole basis for UFOs and all the baggage that goes with it started when a reporter from the East Oregonian newspaper said, "Mr. Arnold, how did they fly?" And he said, "Well, you know, like a saucer if you skimmed it over the water." And of mm-hmm. course, you can guess what the newspaper man wrote in his notes.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote flying saucer. Yeah, little realizing that he was changing the English language forever.
Yeah, so that started the whole thing. Well, let's get back to how you started in everything, because that's fascinating. That is so fascinating to know, you know, the beginning of that. But how did you, because you weren't, I mean, well, I don't know.
I'm not an experiencer or a witness, quite frankly. I get asked this question just about every time I present. Uh-huh. And I always jokingly say always a bridesmaid and never a bride, because I am compelled by the strength of the evidence and the integrity of most all of the witnesses. Mm-hmm. There's just too much information, too much confirmed information. Our problem in the study of UFOs is not that we have too little. Our problem is that we have too much, and it's hard for anybody to get a grip on all of it.
Wow. Well, you know, let's go back in, because you come from police. I mean, I can see how this really, what's the word? I just went blank. Cultivated you to be able to do such wonderful research work in this field, but you were in completely different area before. I mean,
yes.
So let's go back there. So what did you do before? And I'm just trying to figure out how you got into the UFOs then.
Well, actually, it started a long time ago. The seeds were planted.
Okay.
I'm a child of the 50s, thereby revealing my age. I'm halfway through my 60s, and I am now retired from regular work, and I can devote myself totally to ufology, thankfully, finally. But I started a long time ago. I ended up growing up in San Francisco Bay Area. I ended up enlisting in the Army, which is odd because I was in the area against the Vietnam War and all of that. But sometimes life takes you in strange directions. I ended up in the military police because I was always interested in law enforcement, and that seemed to be an avenue. And I ended up in Washington State, and that was in 1975, and I've never regretted my decision to live in this state. It's very beautiful here in the Pacific Northwest, even when it keeps raining for 30 or 40 days straight, like it has recently. Mm. It makes us appreciate the sun more when it does come out.
That's the truth.
But there is one event, actually. There was a particular UFO sighting, and oddly enough, it turns out that Peter Davenport, who runs the National UFO Reporting Center, he and I have this sighting in common, but we came at it two different ways. When Peter Davenport was a young man as a Cub news reporter growing up in the New Hampshire area, his first assignment back in 1965, I believe, was to cover the famous UFO sightings in Exeter, New Hampshire. Some of the primary witnesses to those UFO sightings were on-duty police officers from the Exeter, New Hampshire Police Department. This involved a giant disc-shaped aircraft about 50 feet in diameter with scintillating red lights. It chased a woman in her car down the highway. The officers found her on the street in her car in a state of shock. At about the same time that they made this discovery and were talking to her, the desk sergeant said, "You better get in here," because a hitchhiker had come into the police station independently reporting the exact same UFO. They ended up driving him. An officer drove him back to the scene. And while they were out there, this UFO came up over the trees in this kind of next to this farm. And it got down so low to the ground that the officer pushed the witness down, dropped to one knee, and started to draw his pistol at the same moment that the backup officer was arriving nearby. And the backup officer took one look at the situation and screamed, "Don't do it."
Wow.
Fortunately, he didn't fire, although I doubt that it would have had any effect, judging by what we know. Mm-hmm. But the UFO took off. But these UFO sightings were extensively reported. A very famous author named John G. Fuller, who wrote the first really good book on Betty and Barney Hill a long time ago, called The Interrupted Journey, which was a basis for a movie that was made on the Betty and Barney Hill story. Right. But he also wrote a book, I believe it was in the late 60s, called Incident at Exeter. And a radio broadcaster in San Francisco, California, on KGO Radio, was interviewing John G. Fuller, and he went into depth talking about this UFO sighting at incident in Exeter, New Hampshire. And a young teenager, me, was sitting listening to this on the radio. And I remember that it was a lot of times when you grow up, there's that big weekend when your parents actually let you stay in charge of the house while they're gone.
Right.
And so I was there alone, and I was listening to this radio story about the officers and the UFOs in Exeter, New Hampshire, and people were reporting their cars stalling out in the presence of the UFO. Refrigerators would shut down. TVs would operate funny. I mean, clearly whatever was going on was having physical effects on various types of devices. Clearly, these police officers saw something extraordinary at close range. There were numerous civilian witnesses. There's no reason to believe that they just made all of this up. Mm-hmm. And yet when this report went to the Air Force, they told the officers, well, we were doing high altitude refueling exercises and you don't know what you saw.
Oh my gosh.
And well, that's, you can find this story played out over and over and over again in the history of ufology. But I heard this story, and I was already beginning to think as a teenager that maybe I was going to go into law enforcement, even though that was a very odd time to want to do that. And I just always had a kind of compulsion that way, but the seeds were planted. I was also always fascinated by anything that would be a little out of the ordinary or seemingly impossible. Obviously, I grew up watching science fiction movies, and like many other people, I can tell you that the movie that probably had the greatest effect on me was the original version of The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a timeless classic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we all grew up hearing about the space age and the, you know, the unlimited possibilities of space travel, and the universe keeps expanding. We keep learning more and more about it, and it seems less and less likely that we are all by ourselves. Well, all these things went together, and I always maintained an interest in UFOs, even while I was pursuing a career in law enforcement. And actually, while I was at Fort Lewis one night, I was a plainclothes MP. I did not wear a uniform most of the time I was in the Army. Mm-hmm. I wore a sport coat and a tie, and I carried a concealed weapon, and I worked with the regular military police to do investigations. One night I was talking to the desk sergeant. Now, bear in mind, this is the provost marshal's office, a military police station. I'm up there talking to the desk sergeant. He's got a piece of plexiglass in front of him, and there are all these business cards, you know, who to call if such and such thing happens. And I look down and I see a business card that says National UFO Reporting Center, 206-722-3000. And I said, what's this? And he just turned and looked at me and he said, that's where we report UFOs. And I went, really? And he, you know, it was just a matter of course for him. Now, of course, the National UFO Reporting Center, which is currently run by Peter Davenport since the early 90s, was originally started by Robert Gribble. Robert Gribble was a retired Seattle firefighter who, on his own, out of his own pocket, decided to start the National UFO Reporting Center. And that was quite a feat, because you got to remember, that's back before the internet was going. And he would take the reports over the phone, type up the information, write up a newsletter, and mail it out to people who wanted the information. This is a lot of work.
Yes.
That's a labor of love.
Absolutely.
And, of course, things have evolved since then. But I never forgot that encounter with that, you know, just hearing about that business card. Mm-hmm. And I went on, I was discharged from the Army. I decided to stay in Washington State. I eventually decided to go to work for the city of Aberdeen, Washington, and I worked there for 20 years as a police officer, 10 years of which I was a sergeant, and I was in charge of things like the fatal accident team. I was a detective sergeant. I did a whole lot of different things. This is what you call a mid-size police department, so you had an opportunity to wear multiple hats.
Right.
It wasn't until 1986, I believe, late in the year, I want to say November, that Kenji Tiroshi and his crew aboard a JAL cargo liner flying into Anchorage, Alaska, saw an enormous UFO in the sky, and it was initially confirmed by radar out of Anchorage, Alaska, and in typical government fashion, once it hit the wire services that it was confirmed by the FAA and we had a pilot and crew all reporting this thing, they backed down and said, oh, no, we made a mistake. It wasn't really on the radar. And of course, we now know years later that it was on the radar because the people who were in charge of the radar room have since retired and they've gone public. And there was even some CIA involvement in obtaining the records and suppressing the entire incident. Well, I was fascinated hearing this because it went national. There were national news on that. And so I remembered this phone number from when I was in the Army, and I called it and I said, I don't want to report a UFO. I want to know how I can get off the sidelines. I want to help.
There you go.
And he said, have you ever heard of MUFON? And I said, no. And well, that back then there was a very strong organization here in Washington State up by Seattle. And Peter Davenport was one of the pillars of that. Larry and Marilyn Childs were the co-directors of MUFON in Washington State. And there was quite a group of people in Seattle. Unfortunately, time went by. Peter moved to Eastern Washington. Larry and Marilyn are getting on in years and they couldn't do it anymore. So eventually they passed the torch to me a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been the director ever since. The problem I have, of course, is geography. I live in Olympia, which is about 70 some miles south of Seattle. And, you know, I will tell you that we have some of the best traffic jams up here in Washington State. They're really impressive. Getting in and out of Seattle is no mean feat sometimes.
Oh my. So,
but I've been doing it ever since. And along the way, I've had some extraordinary events happen to me here in Washington State that changed me permanently and totally convinced me how real this whole UFO phenomena really is.
I bet you've seen all kinds of things. I mean, because like you've interviewed, I mean, the abductees, the sites and everything. I mean, you've gone and investigated them. So what, just examples of, like you're saying, it changed your life. I mean, what kind of things have you seen that was like, that did it, that just completely did it?
The number one thing that ever happened to me, I have to say, hands down, was meeting June Crane. That there's nothing else that quite compares to that. And that was completely either by accident or fate, depending on how you would view it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that's very important, I believe, in this field is public outreach. And so many years ago now, I started giving public lectures, mostly in libraries all over Western Washington, whenever I get the opportunity to do a public presentation on UFOs, I do it. And mm-hmm. My goal is not, I don't ever tell people, you know, this is the exact UFO you saw. You know, you saw a 1982 Star Cruiser with a broken taillight and a bent fin.
Right.
No, I don't. And it was piloted by two intoxicated people from Andromeda. No, I don't do that. I don't have those kind of answers.
Mm-hmm.
What I do is I try to give people a different perspective on the high probability that we are being contacted by non-human intelligence pretty routinely, and that we have been contacted throughout history. There is something going on fairly regularly that is very bizarre, and the only way that I can explain it is that it appears to me that although we think we know what reality is, objective reality, we really don't, because there's a lot more to it than what we think. We take a lot of things for granted, and as a culture, most especially, we have blinders on to prevent us from addressing some of the high strangeness events that are occurring routinely around us.
I completely agree. Absolutely. So what are some of the high strangeness? I don't want to take too much away from your talk that you'll be doing at the conference. I mean, we might.
Well, I could tell you the one in particular that I've talked about several times, and I'm not alone in thinking that this is a significant event. In fact, it was one of MUFON's top 10 cases, period, for 2014. Now, the interesting thing about this particular case is that it rests upon the testimony of one witness. And I will also tell you that because of who this witness is, not even MUFON knows who he really is. Because I made a promise that I would never reveal his identity, and I won't do it. This individual works for one of the alphabet soup agencies.
Okay.
And so he put it all on the line. Here's the situation. This is in the middle of 2014. He called me just a few days after it happened. He is in downtown Vancouver, Washington. Now, for those who don't know Northwest geography, the Columbia River divides Washington State and Oregon, the largest city on Interstate 5, just south of the Columbia River, is Portland, Oregon, which obviously is a very large city, and just north across the river in Washington State is Vancouver, Washington, which is a highly developed, growing area since people are commuting back and forth. So we have a fairly large city, broad daylight, excellent weather, excellent visibility conditions. This particular individual is on the job. They are in a particular location waiting for someone to arrive. He's looking towards the river, the Columbia River. There is clear sky, unobstructed view, and he sees a metallic disc appearing to be about as large as a dime held at arm's length go across the sky. And as he put it, he said, "I desperately hoped that it would have propellers, jet engines, wings, anything that would make it normal. It had none of those." And he could see it tilt slightly. And as it tilted, it changed the reflection from the sun on it. So part of it was in shadow. It was apparently solid and metallic. So he's telling me this, and then he says, "But that's not the weird part."
Okay.
And I'm going, "Whoa, this is getting good." So I said, "Tell me more."
Right.
It gets about three quarters of the way across the sky, and he says, "It looks like there's a line in the air. And as the disc crosses the line, it isn't there anymore. There is a ripple, and then it's gone." And he is sitting there with his mouth open and his jaw hanging down. And about that time, here comes an F-15 fighter, presumably from the Oregon Air National Guard, because they do have a group of F-15s on duty, on call at the Portland International Airport. So here comes an F-15 flying wide open in the same direction. And he pointed out to me that when the UFO went across the sky, he could not hear anything. When the F-15 went across the sky, you couldn't hear anything else because he was pouring it on.
Yeah.
And the F-15 just kept right on going. That was the last he saw of it. But see, this whole event is like 30 seconds long, and it completely changed this man's life and completely changed his perspective on everything. But it gets even better because Since he made a report so quickly, I got a hold of a friend of mine named Bill Puckett, who runs UFOs Northwest. That's another excellent website that people can go to. Mm-hmm. And he is a retired NOAA weatherman. And I mean like 30 years in the business total of being a meteorologist or being employed by the federal government. So he knows all about radar.
Mm-hmm.
So I had him make a FOIA request to the FAA, and we got the radar data, and he knows how to unpack it. And in the same area of the sky at the same date and time, the same area where the metallic UFO vanished in the presence of the witness, either because it cloaked or because it just wasn't there anymore, take your pick.
Mm-hmm.
There were solid returns in the sky very briefly of something that did not have a transponder. We also got the F-15 going across the sky very blatantly within the same minute. So, you know, I don't have the UFO that I could bring in on a trailer, but here's my point. Mm-hmm. I have a high credibility witness in a perfect state of health with excellent eyesight, who has no bias towards UFOs, no experience with UFOs, who puts his entire career on the line to make a report about a UFO, and I get radar data that backs up the whole story that he gave me. Now, other than bringing in the UFO on a trailer and walking the pilot in, you know, and having him do part of the presentation, I don't know how much better a UFO report can get.
Exactly. That's fantastic.
It is. And it's and I've been communicating with this individual repeatedly. In fact, I've met him face to face twice because he is now hasn't, like many of these witnesses do, I've had this over and over again. These people develop an insatiable appetite for UFO information. They want to know how to cope with a different reality that they have to face as a result of their UFO experience. And that's the service that I try to provide, which is, you know, I can't give them exact answers, but maybe I can give them a frame of reference where they're better able to contemplate what UFO reality means to them.
Well, that's interesting. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Like kind of what you do there for the frame of reference and everything?
Well, first off, you've got to get off of a Earth-centered and man-centered view of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's number one. That perspective has to go out the window. And of course, if you follow the news these days, that isn't too hard to do, since the universe keeps being bigger and bigger. And I distinctly recall when I was young, they told us with great authority and certainty that there would be no planets out there. And they said, and there certainly won't be any water out there. And therefore, there won't be any life out there. And as the years have gone by, just about everything that they said would never happen has now been proven to exist.
Right, exactly.
So there was a professor somewhere, as I recall the quote, said that the only thing that can be safely said about the future is that everything that hasn't happened yet will, and no one will be safe from it. The universe is expanding. Of course, it always has in our view. You know, the universe has always been what it is. It's our understanding that needs to come up to that level.
Right, right.
I also, you know, the thing about UFOs that has so profoundly changed me over the course of my life, and I don't think I'm alone in saying this, is that when you start seriously exploring the subject of unidentified flying objects, you end up having to study so many different aspects of our experience on the planet Earth. You have to know some astronomy. You have to know some history. When you start dealing with the modern era, you have to look at the politics of the Cold War, what happened after World War II, you know, to try and figure out why our government has taken the particular policy stance that it has, or why other governments have taken a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up studying all of these different things. You know, obviously, if you get into the ancient aliens aspect, you have to start thinking about, have we been told the truth about our history of the human race on planet Earth?
And well, that's a big one.
Yeah, but I'd say the answer is pretty resoundingly no. Mm-hmm. I think we would be horribly shocked if we ever seriously looked at the history of the human race on the planet Earth.
Yeah. Actually, that's an assignment that was given to me by, I'm not sure what did, how, if, okay, if you're into this or not, but like by my higher self, I've got, when I was in Peru, and I was climbing the mountains and climbing, doing things. All of a sudden, I had this knowing that I had to, of what I needed to do. Is like, it's like, put the pieces together, connect the dots, do this, tell everyone this is what they've got to know. It's pretty much what they were saying. It's what you just said. And it's like, you have to completely go back to the beginning and refigure everything out. And so I'm just trying to figure out how I go about doing that now. But
well, I think you're doing it right at this moment. In other words, this is the same. I get asked this question all the time, you know, when will disclosure be?
Mm-hmm.
That's a universal question.
Right.
Well, I look around the room and I say, ladies and gentlemen, disclosure is happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people have a rigid belief system, there is not some magic day when they all wake up and go, wow, I've been wrong about this. We really shouldn't be so secretive about UFOs anymore. And maybe we should tell the truth about Roswell and a whole bunch of other things. That's not going to happen.
Right.
What happens is that the rest of us are going to evolve past them, and we will replace them.
Yeah, but we won't need their confirmation or anything. You know, it's like,
they're not going to confirm it. They can't.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Dolan has pointed out precisely over and over again why disclosure is not going to happen. You know, there's too many vested economic and political reasons that would prevent them from telling the truth. And the person who spills the beans is going to be taking a big risk. You know, and we go through this at least two or three times a year. I've been at this so long. I mean, it's very hard to get me excited, although I will admit that I did spend the $18 to watch the live video stream on the Roswell slides back in 2015. And I ended up feeling very foolish afterwards. But I'm not the only one who got clipped. But at least two or three times a year, somebody will get one of these movements going where, oh my God, we've got the truth. You know, they're going to disclose next week. Everybody should be ready. And almost always it's a bust.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. But I think our disclosure is happening person by person. And I don't find it strange at all. I'm envious of what you said about getting a direct message. You know, whatever my role is in this field, it doesn't appear that my time to get that message has occurred yet, but I've met many people that I know and respect that I don't doubt at all that they've gotten the message.
Okay. Well, what I feel like is though you are someone that helps relay the information that's needed for those messages.
I may be part of the bridge.
Yes.
Because I have, you know, I can say I've been a police officer. I've investigated fatal accidents, murders, child abuse, you know, all the hideous, stupid things that human beings do to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And every veteran cop knows what these things are. And yet at the same time, I still have a great optimism in my life about the human race. And I have a great optimism for the future because, quite frankly, because I think there have been other outside influences, and I really do view I think we are a fledgling juvenile species in the grand scheme of things. And if we don't do something incredibly stupid and wipe ourselves out, we're going to have a grand and glorious future exploring the universe.
I absolutely agree. And I love the way you put that.
So that's my hope. In fact, have you seen the new version of Arrival, the movie called Arrival?
No, I haven't.
Amy Adams is the star. I'm recommending this movie to everybody.
Okay, wonderful.
This is the most sensitive, intellectual treatment of contact with an alien species that I have seen done anywhere. And I found it very haunting. It's also a serious look at the problems that we may face when we try to communicate with a non-human extraterrestrial species, because without giving it away, one of the big problems in the movie is that it turns out that the aliens view time completely different than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And they see time as circular, whereas we see it as linear one way.
Right.
And this becomes a big issue in the movie. The movie is all about communication.
Mm-hmm.
More than it is. It's not about, you know, scaring people or, it's not like Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Mm-hmm.
This movie really is about the deeper issues of how difficult it would be to make that first contact.
That's really interesting. No, I haven't even heard of that movie.
Oh, it's great. The Arrival, there's two versions of it. This is one of the things that's fascinating. Same movie title, back in the early 90s, there's The Arrival with Charlie Sheen. And in that one, the aliens are bad news for the human race.
Mm-hmm.
They are here secretly, deliberately trying to get ourselves to pollute ourselves into oblivion, because it turns out that kind of poisoned world would be perfect for them.
Okay.
Now, in the new version of Arrival, the aliens are here. I don't want to give it away, but they're here for a very positive. It turns out that there is a positive reason for them coming here that is not only beneficial to us right now, but will be beneficial to them at a future date.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different approach to first contact.
Okay, so this brings me to something else. In the cases that you've investigated, when you have talked to, I know a lot of people call them abductees, we call them contactees, mm-hmm. or what is this similar to? I mean, let me.
Yes, there is There is a similarity, and it needs to be pointed out.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Like what they
and
say.
Here's what it is.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Everybody. You got to break it down and realize what you are bringing to the alien encounter. Because it's not just the alien.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think that when we look into those, you know, they're always depicted as having those deep, dark eyes, very mysterious. They don't give away anything emotionally to us, or at least anything that we readily understand.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're seeing reflections of our own insecurities and fears many times.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other thing I would point out is there is not going to be one size fits all in this. I really believe, you know, what form will alien life take? My answer back to that one is what form won't it take? And the reason I say that is I have a very simple model, life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at life on Earth, you know, minus mankind's horrible interference, you'll find a myriad of different species, different sizes, shapes, colors, forms. Life is constantly trying to invent new ways to survive and thrive. Why do we think for a moment that it would be any different out in the universe? I think it's going to be the same pattern.
Exactly.
And my personal theory, which I cannot prove, this is just based upon 30 years of reading, studying, talking to people, devouring ufology every way that I could get at it, short of meeting the alien and having him, you know, fill me in, which, and if the alien's listening and he wants to meet with me, I'm more than willing. But I think there are four forces that we believe hold the universe together. There's the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, and gravity. I submit that there may be more forces, and that the very next one on the list is going to turn out to be life, with a capital L.
Okay.
And I think that life is going to exist everywhere in the universe that it can. And that means there's going to be a wide variety of forms. And if you open your mind to the fact that we have been contacted by non-human intelligence in the form of aliens, whether they come in nuts and bolts spaceships or they dimensionally beam into the Earth or however you want to posit that they may arrive and depart and do whatever they have to do, there's going to be a variety of agendas. They won't be here for just one thing. And so there isn't going to be a one size fits all, so that if you have a bad encounter with an alien, you can't speak for all the aliens. The same thing if you have a good encounter. And we don't even know that they don't have individual personalities and may have individual motives.
That's a very good point there. Yes.
We don't know how they're motivated. They're alien. And we got to be really careful. You have to be really careful that you don't imprint your perceptions of alien intelligence with your human insecurities, prejudices, assumptions, whatever. Almost inevitably, we're going to do that. But we have to be really careful.
Yeah, people do it all the time just within the human race. We do it with other people, you know. We're always putting our things onto someone else, assuming that's what is going on. So of course we would do that in that situation.
We do zero sum thinking, and every time we do that, it gets us in trouble.
So and that's probably why. I mean, they're making, you know, they're approaching people maybe, you know, one at a time. Or they're making appearances, but that's why another reason why they're not going to just come, you know, just be here all in mass and like they say, drop down on the White House lawn because of that. You know, we don't know how to handle others.
We don't. We do a very poor job with each other.
Exactly. So it's probably they're just waiting for us to get our act together and figure this out.
I know, and that could be a long wait. There are times when I wish that they would just come out in the open and you know, upset the status quo. But then, you know, if you think about what would happen, see, Richard Dolan has pointed this out repeatedly. I don't want to take away from his brilliant insight, but I think it's very important. His belief, and I totally agree with this, is that the problem with UFOs, it's not only admitting that we have possibly higher intelligences visiting the Earth, apparently they use transportation that is not based upon hydrocarbon fuels. I've never gotten a UFO report about a UFO with a bad muffler.
I love
can safely say that. So they don't burn oil, which means that they are obviously able to do whatever they need to do with a completely different power source. Now, it's fun to say, okay, they're going to disclose aliens and alien technology tomorrow. It wouldn't be so fun to find out that every single person who works in the hydrocarbon fuel industry is working in a job that is no longer needed. That would completely disrupt our economy. So you don't, you know... I don't know how this would go. Yeah. And I'm sort of hoping, without knowing for sure, that maybe we are gradually being brought up to speed, and the fact that you and I and so many other people are asking these questions and having these experiences and being challenged to see something higher and larger than ourselves and the limited perspectives that we get from our civilization, that maybe we will grow up. And so when the time comes, it won't be such a shock.
Right. Yeah, and like you said, yeah, I think we have a long ways to go, but I think there's great hope for us because we have come a long ways.
We have. I you know, like everybody else, I have days where I get so discouraged by all of this. Even in the field of ufology, I get discouraged.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of junk out there.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is filled with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, everybody wants to send you a cell phone photo and it's a black rectangle with an orange dot in it. And they want you to tell them whether or not they've seen an extraterrestrial spacecraft. I'm serious. Those are the kind of questions I get asked.
Oh, what am
I supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem of being a MUFON investigator. Mm. MUFON makes... And we're made up of human beings. You know, we argue and squabble. Nothing is carved in stone. We're trying to get through this too. But we honestly try to take an objective perspective on what people are reporting as UFOs and try to investigate it based upon some established protocols that we have. Do we always get it right? Probably not. Do we get it right most of the time? Yes, I think we do. And the problem that makes people upset is that I will tell you, and it's not just my own personal experience, although I can tell you that out of 800 UFO cases, this has been pretty consistent, and everybody else reports basically the same thing. Out of any 10 UFO reports that we get, 8 of them will probably have a man-made explanation, a natural explanation, or there will be a small quantity of insufficient information where there just isn't enough there to make a call, and or hoaxes or something like that. 8 out of every 10 fall into that category. Only 1 or 2 of them are what I would call UFO gold. That's where you have a high strangeness event combined with high witness credibility. When you have those two things together, you have gold. That's what we're always looking for. We want the gold. When I described the gentleman who took a great personal risk,
right,
who was a trained professional observer, who saw a metallic craft in broad daylight, who could tell me specifically where it was, where it came from, where it went, what happened to it, the fact that the government was chasing it, all of these things start racking up a higher and higher score for credibility. We have high strangeness. We have high witness credibility. That's UFO gold. So see, that's the kind of investigative system or perspective that people like me use to try and tackle the UFO problem.
Mm-hmm. What I like about what you were saying earlier about giving people perspective is that probably helps tremendously with any fear that's wrapped around people
there's a lot of that. And I will tell you, I've been grateful, especially I have an assistant state director named Alita Deeby, who I am grateful for every day since she got involved and has taken up this cause. She's involved in the national project that MUFON has, which is directed by Kathleen Marden. And Kathleen Marden, for those who don't know, is Betty Hill's niece.
And she's another speaker that will be here at the conference.
I know, and she's a wonderful, highly intellectual, compassionate presenter in this field. She's somebody I have tremendous respect for. And this is dealing with abductees, experiencers, I think is a better word.
Yes.
That's hard. And one of the reasons it's hard is that it's very, very time consuming. You know, people think that when they call that I have this button that I can push and, you know, we're going to send the MUFON SWAT team out with, you know, vans and satellite receivers. And we have trained hypnotherapists standing by waiting for your call. You know, we don't have that. It's all volunteer. We're all volunteers out here.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I think that jars some people because they think that when they call that we, you know, we have all these tremendous resources. Well, we have some resources, and we do have people that are very committed to trying to understand the UFO mystery, but we don't have, you know, I can't push a button and give you a hypnotherapist. It's not going to happen.
Right. So, and what you're saying is like the fear that's wrapped around it. I mean, that's what I was talking
exactly.
about. There's so much fear. Yeah.
And so, but the problem is, I will tell you that the one of the other problems that comes with these people is that by the time they make a report, they've had a lifetime of experiences.
Yes.
And many of these people, probably because of their experiences with non-human intelligence, have had pretty dysfunctional lives.
Right.
And what that does is you now have another whole layer of issues to deal with when you try and sort out what's happening to these people. And see, one of the things that we have to do is also make sure that we do no harm. Whereas I don't want to get involved in someone's personal life where they've had issues, you know, with, say, drug abuse or alcohol abuse or, you know, some sort of family sexual abuse or whatever, and find out that this person is an experiencer. Well, when I start getting an idea that they've got all these other issues going on, you know, I have to back away respectfully and say, you know, this, I can't do this. I'm not a trained professional. You know, you need to go find somebody to help you with these other issues.
Yeah.
And that makes, you know, nobody has a simple life, you know, as far as I've got this perfect life. And oh, by the way, I'm being routinely abducted by aliens.
Yeah.
No, I have not found very many people like that.
Right. Yeah. Cause, and like you said, you know, they might have all these drug issues and things like that. And that's probably is because of.
Exactly. And I'm, you know, and you get into that, which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, are they, and if you try and validate these people and present, you know, if somebody could have a really tragic life with all these things going on, all this dysfunctionality and everything else, and they've also had contact with non-human intelligence, how are you going to take that contact and present it to the public, John Q. public, in such a way that people are not going to be saying, well, yeah, they believe in little green men because, I mean, look at them. They're alcoholics and drug addicts.
Right, yeah.
You know, people want this simplistic explanation for everything when it isn't there.
No, not at all. Well, James, before we start running out of time here, if people want to contact you, what's the good way to do that?
The most direct way is probably email. UFO reality, UFOREALITY at comcast.net, NET. I also have a website, which is jamesclarksonufo.com, and I'm on Facebook.
Fantastic.
So that's probably the best ways. And I will be a very excited participant in Eureka Springs. I believe, according to the schedule, that I get to be the opening speaker.
Yes, you're special.
I've done this before at other places, so I have to get in there and really get people excited. Not that they won't be excited anyway, but we got to build it up, you know.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be a problem for you.
It's not. I'm very passionate about this, and this is the 30th year. This is also the 70th anniversary of Roswell this year.
Oh my goodness.
And I will be there for that too.
Yeah.
This is turning out to be a really, really great year.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
So I'm having all kinds of fun. I love Roswell. I love Eureka Springs too. That's why I say I get to go to two of my favorite conferences, and I will be going to McMinnville, Oregon, which I don't know if you know about that one, but they have an annual UFO conference there.
Okay.
And
no, I don't know about that one, huh?
It commemorates the Trent photographs that were taken on May 11th of 1950 outside of McMinnville, Oregon. Some of the best broad daylight UFO photos ever taken. Even the U.S. Air Force has been unable to discredit those photos. Well, I think we're up to the 18th annual festival this year.
Oh, wow.
And it's turned into, the whole town turns out for a giant UFO parade. They have serious speakers, and then they have a whole lot of fun events. Like they have, it culminates in an alien ball in this old hotel where everyone drinks too much and wears weird costumes.
Uh-huh.
It's quite
fun.
An event.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that all sounds so fantastic.
There's a lot going on this year.
Yeah.
And then plus we have, there's a lot of really strange sightings. We just finished up with one over by Richland. I have a retired chief of police and his wife, his granddaughter, and the granddaughter's boyfriend. He's out back, and he saw a giant UFO.
Oh, my goodness.
And we confirmed it on radar. And I'll bet we're running out of time.
Yeah, we are. We are out of time. And that's, oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for being with us, James. And thank you. Thank you. And everybody, come on. Come and see him. Get more information at the conference, April 14th to 16th, Ozark UFO Conference. Thank you, everyone. I love you. And have a wonderful week. And thank you so much, James, for being here.